This week on Your Western Context, doctors don't advocate lockdowns, yet some provinces do. The media turns the BC election debate into a race debate, and the Trudeau Liberals continue to censor the Wii scandal. Also, a BC murder mystery and Chinese secret boot camps raise questions. This is Western Context, episode 191, recorded Friday, October 16th, 2020. The BC murder mystery. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are in, as we are each and every week, and will be in each and every week to talk about the news, some of the news that the media missed, and in general, just some news stories that are just downright baffling this week.
Yes, that's for sure. Some stories that have surfaced this past week that have connected a lot of different dots that the media hasn't really been talking about very much, and certainly some very baffling stories that went unreported out there that we're now going to be covering for you.
Yeah, and you know, when it comes to talking about these news stories, sometimes they're very time sensitive and sometimes they're not, and they still have that impact that they do months and sometimes years after they happen. And we're going to be talking about one of those this week that goes back a little bit on that. But if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that aims to cut through all the media bias and sensationalism that you find out there, whether it be in the newspapers or on the evening news, and in doing so, we'll hopefully provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin this week with one of our Canada stories because, you know, national media has been warning us for weeks and months of a potential second wave of the coronavirus, but whether or not it has materialized ultimately depends where you live and what reality you live in, and we'll get to what exactly this means a little bit later on. We've seen the government of Ontario impose new restrictions in an attempt to curb the virus, and the question of how much socialization is too much is something that's been asked many times since early March. Now, to have a bit of a look at what could be going on and what is going on in the U.S. state of South Dakota, today Governor Kristi Noem announced that South Dakota's unemployment rate dropped to 4.1% in September. South Dakota had no lockdown, no advised shutdowns, and fosters a positive business environment for every business in their state, but most importantly, the energy industry. And that energy industry isn't shunned either at the state or federal level. And when it comes to policy, both on energy policy and the environment, this could have been us. Now, the reason we're talking about this, though, is that this has something to do with a statement that came out of the WHO this week. Now, to be clear, the group of doctors speaking doesn't represent the official stance of the huge international body of the World Health Organization. They're just a big part of it. Dr. David Nabarro of the WHO told world leaders this week that we in the World Health Organization do not advocate lockdowns as the primary means of control of this virus. And this is something that is going to make many people scratch their heads. And if you haven't heard this yet this week, you're probably wondering why, and we'll get to that in just a bit. Now, what they said after this was very telling. The only time we believe a lockdown is justified is to buy you time to reorganize, regroup, rebalance your resources, and protect your healthcare workers who are exhausted, but by and large, we'd rather not do it. They also point out that poorer economies have been disproportionately impacted, and examples given being the tourism industry in the Caribbean or small farmers across the world. Melbourne's lockdown in Australia has been hailed as one of the strictest and longest. In Spain, they locked down in March, where people weren't allowed to leave their house unless it was to walk their pet. And in China, authorities ultimately welded doors shut to prevent people from leaving their homes. The WHO believes that all of these steps were largely unnecessary. Here in Alberta, Premier Jason Kenney sees that he sees the path that Alberta took as one step above of that was taken in South Dakota or Sweden, as in we still had some restrictions, but it was by and large up to the population to determine what happened. But of course, we were encumbered by fear, which was peddled by our national government and the national media establishment. Just this week, the Toronto Sun ran an editorial piece comparing the stances of Alberta and Ontario. The editorial compares the two provinces and notes the path that Ontario is taking compared to the path of Alberta. To quote the Alberta Premier in their editorial, they said, "We're not going to enforce our way out of COVID. Alberta's approach is to focus on the broader health of society, physical, mental, social, and economic, by encouraging personal responsibility rather than micromanaging people's lives." Now, this stance was also backed up by Alberta's Dr. Hinshaw, who early on said that enforcement won't work as a lone strategy against this virus. Now, in addition to what Jason Kenney has been saying, and now what the doctors of the WHO are saying, a group of physicians from prestigious health institutes such as Stanford, Harvard, and Oxford, among others, came together to create a petition called the Great Barrington Declaration. The declaration reads, "As infectious diseases and epidemiologists and public health scientists, we have grave concerns about the damaging physical and mental health impacts of the prevailing COVID-19 policies, and we recommend an approach we call focused protection." Now, as of recording, there have been 28,000-plus medical practitioners, 10,000-plus medical and public health scientists, and 509,000 concerned citizens to have signed this petition. Now, their stance on focused protection is highlighted as being the most compassionate approach that balances risks and benefits of reaching herd immunity, and it's to allow for those who are at minimal risk of death to continue to live their lives normally to build up immunity to the virus through natural infection, while better protecting those who are at highest risk. Now, with this, if you look at our national media establishment this week, all you would have seen was pushback against the Great Barrington Declaration, a poll from Nanos saying that the majority of Canadians support closing non-essential businesses, though non-essential is going to be defined for everybody who took that poll. And with the exception of one piece out of CTV, this was the course that you would have heard in Canada this week. The piece from the CTV says that without the data to show how, where, and why infection spots are going hot, hitting hospitality, sports, and fitness sectors with widespread clampdowns are a lazy, ineffective, and irresponsible response. To close hundreds of safety-enhanced gyms and other indoor venues in Toronto and Ottawa because one spin class in Hamilton triggered an outbreak is overreaching madness. To shutter all indoor dining, even those which have taken costly precautions to make it safe, punishes an entire industry for the careless sins of a few, if indeed any are an actual source of transmission. And this was in an article on ctvnews.ca written by Don Martin. And this is the story of what lockdowns were initially meant to be used for: time to allow the healthcare system and businesses to get ready. Now, shutting them down again just seems careless in this perspective. The pandemic has also been an exercise in defining reality based upon which media you consume, which data you look at, and what your perspective is. In Alberta, if we look at people aged 1 to 59, there have been 12 deaths since the virus arrived. If we add in people aged 60 to 69, this number goes up to 35, and this is a far cry from the 288 that the province lists who have died in total from the virus. Now, even if you add those up to the age of 79, that number only goes up to 102. Now, we don't have data for all of Canada here, since most of the data portals available nationally don't provide a granular filtering system as the one for Alberta does, but this shows that when factoring in the economy, what South Dakota did, what the Great Barrington doctors say, it shows that their idea isn't actually that far-fetched, and it can be backed up by the data that we see here in Alberta. So ask yourselves then, why is the media fear-peddling? Why is the media advocating lockdowns? And why is discussion of the Great Barrington Declaration limited online? It's a question that perhaps no one is brave enough to ask, and we will, and we see the results here in Alberta.
Yeah, it's definitely a very interesting question to ponder over, because as we've seen since the start of the pandemic, we've seen very, very many different conflicting information channels, both from the government and from the media, and from international media worldwide that our Canadian media always seems to get swallowed up by. And I think that there's been so many different options out there and options for combating the virus that now, as we're coming up on 7 months in, I think a lot of the public is just they're tuning it out completely, and they're just doing what they think is best at this point. And I think that a lot of cases that we're seeing in Eastern Canada may just well be down to the fact that the media and the government got it wrong in the beginning, so people don't trust them to make the right decisions now, and they're making their own decisions on this matter. And whether or not that people are actually spreading this is, it comes down to those particular spots in those particular communities. And I think that a far-reaching provincial-wide mandate for a lockdown or restrictions is not going to be very effective, because it's not targeting the communities that are actually undergoing the eruptions of the cases. And I think that a lot of people aren't looking at that in that perspective. They're looking at the news stories that are coming out that are mostly reporting on a provincial-wide level, and they're not really looking at where these cases actually are. And I think that a lot of the media isn't doing a great service for the Canadian public, because they're just trying to get clicks. And I think that's something that has been missed by a lot of the media, and it's certainly not been talked about very much.
Yeah, and, you know, there's also the age-old question of, you know, is reporting cases at this point, 7 months down the line, still a viable option and something the media should be doing? Because if you have 32 new cases today, those 32 new cases, if you're doing 5,000 tests, is different than if you had 32 cases back in May and you were doing 2,500 tests in that one day. And based on that perspective, those 32 cases aren't the same. And we're having these constant case numbers bombarded to us day by day, nationally, provincially, how many of them there are. But when you look at the data, when you look at what's happening underneath, those two numbers, 32 cases back in May versus 32 cases today, they don't mean the same thing. And that's something that's entirely missed based on what has been talked about in the media. And it's quite baffling to see that the media continues to progress on this angle that is exactly the same as it was back in March and April, when we have these doctors from these very prestigious institutes, these doctors who take oaths to do no harm, these doctors who publish scientific papers, who are coming out and saying that these lockdowns don't work. But yet again, we have one of the biggest province in Ontario, or the biggest province in Canada, pushing on that direction. And there are people in Alberta, in BC, who would like us to get to that point too. And this is something that the population needs to be aware of, and it's on the media to report this. And unfortunately, they won't, and that's why we're talking about that today here on our podcast.
Yes, and one other note on this is that if we look at businesses that could be affected by this lockdown, we have to look at what time of year this is. We're into the middle of October, and the season for retail is going to be coming up very soon, where Black Friday sales are going to be starting to happen. People are going to be starting to buy things for Christmas, and a lot of people are concerned about heading out into bigger mall areas where there might be a lot of people. And I think that with these cases, if there's a lockdown that does happen, that means that those businesses are not going to be able to rely on their traditional fourth quarter revenue that a lot of companies do for the rest of the year. And there's going to be a lot of closures of businesses completely across the board. I think it's estimated at some point that there's anywhere up to 35% of businesses that are already on the brink of shutting down. And if there is another lockdown that happens, that could raise quite a bit higher. And I think that the economic impacts of another lockdown that could happen, no matter where it is in Canada, could be catastrophic for the local economies. And I think that's something that also gets missed in the reports on the coronavirus pandemic, is that there are huge economic tolls that could be coming out of this, and no one's talking about it.
Yeah, and you know, the media doesn't care because they're in their bubbles in Toronto and Montreal, and they report out west, and you know, they're always going to have a job based on that. They get their money from the federal government to subsidize them, and at the end of the day, nothing changes for them. But it's a very different reality for run-of-the-mill businesses, which nobody is talking about, and that's why this is such an important story. And it should have been headline news this week, but it just was not. It was headline news in all the wrong ways, and that's why we talk about about it. And if you want to help us do these pieces of coverage on this, things that the media misses, you can check our Patreon page at patreon.com/westerncontext, where you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose to. For $2 a month, the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. Or for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production show notes throughout the entire week. Now, in case you're wondering what we're going to be doing with this, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, we'll craft 2 Patreon exclusive articles expanding on our coverage of the show stories from the month, and these articles will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $50 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs may be headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. Now, with that, we're going to move on to one of our BC stories, as one of the other ones is going to be a firing line, a little bit of a teaser there going forward, but we're going to check in on what exactly is happening with the BC election.
Yes, on Tuesday, the only televised debate of the BC election campaign was held, and of course the election is set to conclude on October 24th, and the debate brought about a lively yet mostly respectful debate about a wide range of issues, and no candidate had any true knockout blows during the debate, but all three of the main party leaders raised their profile and gained publicity for their party's platforms in doing so. Now, incumbent BC NDP Premier John Horgan, who called the snap election a month ago, spent much of the night on the defensive from the two opposition leaders, BC Liberal leader Andrew Wilkinson and new Green leader Sonia Furstenau, who was elected leader just a few days before the election was called. Now, Horgan's calling the snap election was fiercely condemned by both Wilkinson and Furstenau, with the Greens being the former confidence and supply partners for the government, taking the greatest offense at the sudden dismissal of the agreement to call an election a full year early in the midst of the pandemic. Now, there are many issues debated by the three leaders, who were held on task by debate moderator Shachi Curl, who is the president of the Angus Reid polling firm. Highlights included Horgan and Wilkinson trying to pin the blame on each other for the housing crisis. Now, the pandemic also loomed in the background as well, with Horgan blaming Wilkinson for long-term care staffing shortages, and Wilkinson taking Horgan to task on not building any new hospitals in the province in the last few years that the NDP has been in power. Now, Wilkinson also drew attention to the ongoing homeless encampments in some BC cities, most notably Vancouver and Victoria, but also around the province as well. And he also slammed the NDP's approach to homelessness as a colossal failure that's led to what he called, quote, street disorder. Now, Horgan argued that the problem preceded his government, and that's what's needed from political leaders is what he called, quote, compassion, not contempt. And he reckoned that his strategy of purchasing hotels and moving people into them has worked to slow the increase. But Wilkinson said that the current policies are nothing more than a band-aid solution, and that the problems run much deeper than just providing shelter. Wilkinson accused the NDP of chasing a failed strategy and called on Horgan to, quote, stop pursuing a dead end. And he said, quote, I've said let's treat the causes and prevent the harm. Why aren't we treating these mental illnesses? They don't get treated with a tent or a run-down motel. But all those, the economy, healthcare, rising homeless numbers, and the housing crisis, all very important issues to all British Columbians, took a back seat to a very different issue that dominated the provincial media in the days following the debate. Now, during Tuesday's debate, the leaders were asked to explain how they've reckoned with their own privileged positions as white people. Horgan went first and spoke of playing lacrosse with Indigenous young people and suggested that he did not see color growing up. Now, that answer, as in not seeing color, was once widely accepted among liberals in the Western world and has come under fire recently, especially in the last year, with the idea that if you don't see color, you don't understand the differences that people of different colors have and the challenges that they face just based on their skin color. Now, on the defensive immediately by a rash of articles posted in left-leaning publications like the TIE, CBC, and the Globe and Mail, among others, Horgan released a statement the very next day. He said, quote, "As a personification of white privilege, I misspoke. Words matter. I deeply regret it. I am also absolutely committed to making sure that every day I am reminded of the discomfort I cause to people, and I will work to correct that. I'll never fully understand, as a white person, the lived reality of systemic racism. I'm listening, learning, and I'll keep working every day to do better." Now, you would think that that's quite an apology and is going well and beyond to correct his mistakes, but that apology still didn't go far enough for some. For Genevieve Fuji-Johnson, who is a political science professor at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, that apology suggests that Horgan still doesn't quite understand the issue. She said, quote, "So often, colorblindness is synonymous for words like neutral and fair, and to make the suggestion that beliefs and behaviors and laws and policies and institutions are neutral or fair just totally glosses over the myriad of forms of oppression and indeed violence that racialized people and minorities face at the hands of supposedly neutral laws and institutions," which is a lot of words to say that he didn't go far enough, as I mentioned earlier. Now, Wilkinson's answer to the same question was also criticized following the debate. In his response, the Liberal leader told a story about working as a doctor in rural areas of BC, such as Lillooet and Dease Lake, which is one of the most northern communities in BC. And he followed up with a bizarre story about delivering an Indigenous baby who was later named after him. So apparently there's a First Nations baby out there named Andrew who's probably getting a lot of attention because of this. Now, Wilkinson was also quick to expand on his comments the very next day, and he said that he grew up fortunate as a white male and that it wasn't until his teenage years that he realized he received different treatment than others, saying that it was wrong and not fair. He said, quote, "In medical practice, I became very much aware of the particular struggles of Indigenous people in dealing with the healthcare system and in dealing with society's other structures. The idea that people in our society are somehow treated differently because of the color of their skin or where they grew up or who their parents are is not acceptable." Now, Sonia Furstenow said at the debate that she cannot comprehend that some mothers have to tell their children to be wary of the police. She pledged to work to end systemic racism, but admitted that neither she nor the other two party leaders could ever grasp its nuances. Now, media stories about the supposed racism or the not being able to see race of the party leaders followed very quickly after the debate. And despite all the other topics being discussed and all the other issues that permeate into BC life, amazingly, with very many other topics that could have been expanded on, the media decided that this particular part of the story was more important than all others for the public to hear. Now, missing from the media this week was the large increase of voter mail ballot requests and the news from Elections BC that is warning voters that some people could receive their mail-in ballot after the recommended return deadline. British Columbians have been told to mail back their completed voting package by October 17th to ensure their ballot is counted. But Elections BC said that people who requested their package late could end up receiving it after the weekend. Now, with the COVID-19 pandemic ongoing, an unprecedented number of British Columbians have requested mail-in ballots this election, almost 700,000 as of Tuesday. Now, it's unclear how many might end up being received after the recommended return deadline. Now, with many pandemic-frightened people at the mercy of Canada Post, as they were during the electoral reform referendum in 2018 when Canada Post workers went on strike, it's clear that many people will not even bother to vote this time around, or if they do, they'll be sending in a mail-in ballot that won't get counted because it'll be after the deadline. Many people with health risks could risk being disenfranchised, but the media didn't mention all that this weekend. They preferred to talk about race relations instead, and the fact that, apparently, our political leaders don't answer well enough when it comes to race.
And this even goes back to what we were talking about in the Barrington story, because you know, it seems as though that there's a set worldview out there that the media sees, and that's what they want to pontificate on. They want to talk about what exactly, or rather not using the proper language, as Andrew Wilkinson didn't. And, you know, there is a bigger issue with this. 680,000 people who have requested mail-in ballots that could potentially not turn up on time. That's a bigger issue than any of this because, you know, as we say here, elections have consequences. But there's also the side that an election is critical to democracy, and democracy is critical to what we know as Western society. And if that can't be upheld, we are nothing. And, you know, with that, there's another election going on this weekend in New Zealand, and they have a mail-in voting system, but that mail-in voting system is for people who can not make it physically to a polling place or are in a rest home or in the hospital with COVID-19. And as a result of that, everybody else has been early voting and everybody else has been going out to polling places in New Zealand. So this massive shift that we're seeing towards mail-in voting, both here in BC and even in the US, you know, you have to kind of question if that's even necessary. But of course, that's a different story in itself. And the very fact we're talking 680,000 ballots when the media is slicing hairs about what one leader said or what one leader didn't say and who could go the furthest to prove, I guess you could say, their privilege and that they're aware of it, just speaks to what we're here for at Western Context.
Yeah, I think it's really baffling that all of the topics about the debate, this was the one that grabbed the media headlines. And for certain, I mean, having listened to the debate myself, I certainly could have heard a much better answer on this topic. And I probably could have given a better one myself than any of the three leaders gave. But I think that, and that's without media training or coaching, mind you. And I think that a lot of the answers that they gave throughout the debate were quite clearly coached questions that they were trying to use to catch the other leaders off guard. But the other leaders were also coached, and that they were also recognizing that these answers might come up. But this question seemed to catch them all off guard, and it seemed to be that these three answers were some of the only honest answers that we received out of the politicians this evening. And I think that a lot of the cases in that the media decided to blow up on this particular issue because that's the one that they wanted to talk about because they could get the most clicks out of clickbaity headlines. And as we've seen so often, it's quite often the media is not focusing on the issue that actually the most British Columbians are actually caring about, which is, quite frankly, right now, it's the pandemic and what's going on with that. And a very close second would be the economy and how people are faring with jobs and their money issues. And I think that the media could be talking a lot more about that, but instead they're talking about people with race relation issues and apparently apologies that don't go quite far enough.
That's right. And, you know, when it comes to debate formatting, you have to question if you want a debate like this or if you just want a debate with no moderator where, you know, here's a list of topics, prove to the audience for the next hour and a half why you should be the next premier. Or maybe you want a spectacle like we saw in the first presidential debate that was more like a WWE wrestling match, which some people actually found enjoyable. And that's a question listeners are going to have to think about and BCers are going to have to think about. But, you know, when it comes to wrestling matches and boxing matches, we had one of those actually go on in the House of Commons this week. Two committees were filibustered by the Liberals. And, you know, most of the media this week has been focused on other issues, either the perceived arrival of the second wave, as we talked about in the first story, the U.S. election, or, as we saw just in B.C., an issue that doesn't really matter. And once again, ignoring what issues do truly matter. But yet again, here's something else that wasn't talked about in our national media. And what happened was there was this filibuster going on of two committees. And as it was happening with this, the stars were aligning for what turned out to be a very long session in these committees. Now, just before we get too far into the weeds of this one, because this story is a bit in the weeds, a filibuster is the act of a government or opposition talking at length, often for hours on end, to delay the vote or passage of a bill. Now, this time it was two House of Commons committees, the Finance Committee and the Ethics Committee that were being filibustered by the government Liberals. The Finance Committee met for 11 hours, and the Ethics Committee met for 10 hours. The Finance Committee was seeking to reveal redacted information from the nearly 5,000 pages of documents that the government released this past summer in relation to the Wii scandal, and the Ethics Committee was looking to probe just what Justin Trudeau's wife, mother, and brother were paid for by Wii over the last 12 years, and the fiasco ended early in the morning today when the Bloc and Liberals joined in shutting down the voting temporarily. Now, the push to investigate what actually happened with Wii is still ongoing, and whether or not Trudeau will be held accountable for the $40 million plus paid by the government for the contract and the $350,000 plus his family received in payments from Wii is yet to be known. But the story gets more interesting since, of course, the NDP have supported the government preventing its fall numerous times this session. Liberal MP Han Dong instead argued that the committee, which deals with access to information and privacy issues as well, should be dealing with the impact of facial recognition technology on people of color rather than pursuing the Wii scandal. Opposition MPs, including NDP MP Charlie Angus, interrupted Dong's question and Dong had called it a microaggression, saying that this constant interruption I know is not the intent of my honorable colleagues, but it just reminds me of the microaggressions that a lot of Canadians of color face. I don't hear other members being interrupted. Charlie Angus said that Dong should not be playing games, and if the Wii documents motion came to a vote, then the committee could move on and look at Dong's motion. Now, of course, the topic of discussion on this will be whether or not it's worth delaying hours to put forward a vote on the Wii scandal, which the Ethics Commissioner is already investigating. And there may also be the question, why waste the time with a filibuster when it looks childish? But one question that isn't being asked is why senior NDP MPs, most notably Charlie Angus and Peter Julian, are leading this charge, and NDP leader Jagmeet Singh is silent. Peter Julian commented on Twitter, Finance Committee, FNIA, is scheduled to start in an hour, has now been cancelled. 200 hours of Liberal stalling since motion moved to inform House of Commons and Speaker of unprecedented censoring of 1,000-plus pages of documents connected to Wii scandal. What is the Prime Minister hiding? Now, Singh has been silent online, only talking about the BC election and standing with National Chief Perry Bellegarde of the Assembly of First Nations. And in fact, since the public commons vote last week, shutting down a wider push into proroguing Parliament and investigating Wii, Singh has actually been very quiet on Wii itself. Instead, we see it's his front bench, perhaps the future leaders of the NDP, leading this push. And, you know, this is a lesson for Jagmeet Singh that if you intend on being Prime Minister one day, you first have to act in the role, which means acting as an opposition leader and holding the government to account. This just furthers the supposition from last week that the NDP have agreed to put up token opposition against Wii, at least when it counts, and other times at least let's just let the government slide through. Now, this is how the NDP have become neutralized, and we wound up in this social democratic coalition that we talked about last week. And as anticipated during the last election call, it will be the Conservatives and Bloc to hold the government to account while the NDP goes along with the Liberals.
Yes, it's very interesting to see that the NDP front bench is going against the Liberals on the Wii charity scandal that we're still trying to figure out information on, and that the government is desperately trying to cancel any committee look into and trying to censor as much of the information as possible, which normally is used for any documents surrounding national security, but instead we're getting something that's quite far away from national security, and yet it's getting censored as well. Instead, Jagmeet Singh, as you noted on Twitter, is spending his time advocating for local BC NDP candidates and doing photo ops around BC and seemingly doing his best to try and get Premier John Horgan reelected instead of, you know, talking about federal issues that he was elected for. And if he wanted to run for the BC NDP, he should have not decided to become the leader of the federal NDP in this case. And I think that he's the only leader that's actually advocating for a for a particular party in the federal election. Instead, he's not talking about the issues that are surrounding this whole scandal here, and the fact that it took a filibuster from the opposition to be able to actually put this into the media's frame of mind. The fact that this wouldn't even get discussed if there wasn't a hours-long filibuster going on, it's amazing that this story wouldn't have even made it into the media otherwise.
Yeah, and you know, when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, it's Canadians who are not served by this, because almost a year ago, they elected these MPs to do this. They elected a minority government. We didn't know exactly what shape or form that would take, and you know, when it came down to it, at the end of the day, the entire agenda for this year has unfortunately been upended, but it is still up to the government and the opposition to work together to solve these things. And when the opposition has questions like this for something that is clearly not a national security issue, the government should just provide this data and deal with it. And you know, the more that this is delayed, it raises more questions about what exactly the Prime Minister has to hide on this. And that is yet another question that was not asked by the media this week. So we're going to move on to our firing line segment right now. And this one is also a hybrid BC story, but it also touches on Canadian national security issues as well. And, you know, we didn't hear about this one when it happened. And we don't blame you if you guys didn't hear about it either. And it is a major head scratcher.
Yes, that's for sure. This was a story that was originally reported back in July, and for some reason it didn't make headlines whatsoever. There was only a couple stories about this. The media seemed to completely gloss over it altogether, and it's only in the last week that since other headlines have come up surrounding this story that we've actually heard about it. And as we mentioned this past summer, news broke about a strange disturbance on quiet Salt Spring Island, the largest of the Gulf Islands located between Vancouver and Vancouver Island. Now, Salt Spring is known for being away from the big city lifestyle of both Victoria and Vancouver, and from its very beginnings, it was known as a multicultural haven of alternate lifestyles. And this day and age, you could read that as being left-wing green hippie politics, and that's not even an exaggeration. That's exactly what it is. It's the riding that elected the first green MP in Canada. It's the riding where the first green MLA was elected in Canada as well, and it's been a great movement for green politics out of the country. So yeah, it's not even an exaggeration that much of the island is very left-wing and very much involved with green politics. Now, resident Joe Clemente was out for a drive on the northern part of the island in March 2018 when he came across about 50 people marching in military camouflage fatigues and boots. Now, Clemente's 35-second video shows that they were primarily women and apparently Chinese. Now, let's reconcile that with the fact that this is in a very small island where a lot of people go to get away from the big city. They go to get away from the notice of a lot of other big city lifestyles, such as the police, perhaps, and that it's a very, very left-wing, laid-back community. And instead, we've got what seems to be a Chinese army encampment on the island. And this is something that is very strange and is still head-scratching today. Now, Clemente, who is still wondering if he happened upon training for a cult, said that, quote, "Not a lot of things shock me, but that shocked me. We don't have any military bases here. If it was hippies with dreadlocks, I wouldn't even think twice about it. We have a lot of earthy people out here. I'd say, oh, just a bunch of hippies out on a march. But this was something completely different." Another area resident, Kathy Wisner, was gardening when she spotted what she thought were cadets training one afternoon the week before Clemente's experience. Their commander had barked out instructions in a language other than English, and frightened, she went into her house, called her husband, and ended up calling the police. Now, Clemente said that he had heard rumors of a large group booking at Mineral Springs Resort, which is a secluded seaside getaway on Salt Spring Island. Now, a joint investigation by the Breaker.News and CTV News Vancouver reveals that the owner's connections to companies and real estate in Langley in Surrey included a crime scene in Grandview Heights in Surrey. Now, Bo Fan, who was a 41-year-old who came to Canada from China in February 2019, was the victim of a murder on June 17th. RCMP initially pinpointed a property on 27th Avenue, the headquarters of Crate Abundance International Institute, Inc., which owns Mineral Springs, the venue for the boot camps. Now, police are still baffled as to how Miss Fan died and are still looking for answers about her final days. Since releasing photographs of Fan on June 24th, earlier this summer, Sergeant Frank Jang of the Integrated Homicide Investigation Team said that clues have come in, but not enough, and they're hoping that more people come forward. Jang said that Fan had clients as part of her duties, though investigators said that the exact nature of her employment remains unclear, commenting that it's almost like a mystery novel. Now, Fan was employed by Creative Abundance and its affiliate, Golden Touch. The multi-level marketing organizations are based on a spiritual, psychological, and financial philosophy book. Golden Touch claims to be more than a series of courses, seminars, and workshops. It says that it's a spiritual growth system, and it boasts a network of clubs in major cities across North America, Europe, and Asia. In Chinese, there was a pamphlet released by the organization, which refers to Golden Touch as a global communication organization committed to, quote, spreading of spiritual wisdom of Chinese culture. The pamphlet also said that workshop attendees gain inspiration, confidence, influence, charm, and wealth. It said, quote, your income will magically increase. All your fears and limitations about money will be destroyed. Now, the group charged $200 to $300 for admission to seminars at the Richmond Sheraton Airport Hotel. A notice for the two-day course also mentions the Mineral Springs Resort. Other conferences were hosted in an amphitheater aboard a Pacific Cruises ship. Golden Touch operates several multi-million dollar properties out of Langley in Surrey, which are described as having tour buses of people visit daily for meetings. Now, it turns out that the home where the murder victim worked, which corporate records indicate is Golden Touch's BC headquarters, is also linked to at least five other companies, all of whose names begin with the letter GT, standing for Golden Touch. For all five, corporate registries list the home where the source has said that Fan worked as the mailing address. The address is for the directors, who could have potentially have information about Golden Touch, or a way to contact their corporate leadership, led CTV News to four new homes in Surrey and into Langley. And when they were discovered and visited, nobody answered any of the front doors to answer any questions. Now, the RCMP described murder mystery as not the only intrusion into Canadian life that powerful Chinese figures seem to be doing. Members of the Canada Chinese business establishment in Beijing applauded a senior Chinese official who demanded the release of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou and held Ottawa solely responsible for the problems between the two countries. Loud clapping rang out in a ballroom at the Four Seasons Hotel in Beijing on Tuesday when Vice Minister of Commerce Wang Shouwen called for Ms. Meng to, quote, come back to her homeland as soon as possible. He was speaking at a dinner for the Canada-Chinese Business Council annual general meeting, and this was the 50th year anniversary of that council. Now, the room remained quiet when the Canadian government asked for equal treatment. Silence followed when Mary Ng, who is the Minister of Small Business, Export Promotion and International Trade, called for the release of Canadians Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, who are held in Spartan Chinese detention centers, and requested clemency for Robert Schellenberg, who is a Canadian sentenced to death on drug charges. It was silenced, too, when Canadian Ambassador Dominic Barton called for the same. Now, Olivier Desmarais, who is the scion of one of Canada's most influential corporate families, who is also senior vice president of Power Corp and chairs the business council, says, quote, this issue has been dragging is very frustrating, and he mentions that members of the group, quote, very much want to see these legal cases resolved. Demaree's comments express a sentiment that has grown among a business establishment that sees China as a place of long-term growth and immediate solve to the pain of the pandemic, despite China actually being the perpetrator of the pandemic in the first place. Now, while Canada's worldwide exports fell 16.7% in the first 7 months of the year, they were actually up 2.2% to China. This contrasts with the greater public, where opinions toward China have plunged to levels never before recorded, with 73% now holding unfavorable views of the country. Canadian businesses, however, continue to press for greater ties, and the Chinese government is renewing its push for a trade deal. A, quote, free trade agreement is in line with our interests, Mr. Wang, the vice minister, said on Tuesday, adding that liberalized trade could expand flows of capital and talent and, quote, bring more dividends to people on both sides. He said that, quote, China is opening its door wider and wider. Canada could open its door wider and wider to China as well. He assigned Ottawa full blame for problems between the two countries, and he said, quote, the source of those difficulties and responsibility for them does not lie with the Chinese side. Meanwhile, while all of the political sparring is going on, Canadian businesses are ramping up the Chinese side of their businesses, including Tim Hortons, Lululemon, Canada Goose, and Arc'teryx, the latter of which is now even owned by a Chinese company. Now, Chinese institutions are already been infiltrating into healthcare, as previously mentioned on Western Context, and are also filtering into education. The Confucius Institute, which is a controversial Chinese-backed educational organization, has taken a direct role in supporting Mandarin classes in some British Columbia schools, while also asking local officials to report back on all political developments. Now, for years, school district number 43 in Coquitlam, BC, has dismissed critics of its Confucius Institute programming, which primarily delivers extracurricular Mandarin instruction and cultural programming that is backed and partly funded by the Chinese government. The Institute has taken a more expansive role lately, even providing resources for core classes as well. Now, China's ambassador to Canada is also urging Ottawa to stop granting asylum to democracy activists from Hong Kong, who he described as violent criminals, and he also warned that accepting these people could jeopardize the, quote, health and safety of 300,000 Canadians who live in the former British colony. Asked if he was issuing a threat, envoy Kong Pei-Wu replied, quote, that is your interpretation. Now, Kong used a news conference on Thursday, marking the 50th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the two countries, to say that Beijing finds it unacceptable that Canada recently accepted two Hong Kong pro-democracy dissidents as political refugees. He also took strong exception to a call from nearly 60 MPs and senators to shelter more Hong Kong residents fleeing China's national security law. He said, quote, we strongly urge the Canadian side not to grant so-called political asylum to those violent criminals in Hong Kong because it is interference in China's domestic affairs and will certainly embolden those violent criminals. Kong indicated that any further action to shelter Hong Kong residents could have consequences for the many Canadians living in the Asian financial hub. He said, quote, if the Canadian side really cares about the stability and prosperity in Hong Kong and really cares about the good health and safety of those 300,000 Canadian passport holders in Hong Kong and the large number of Canadian companies operating in Hong Kong, you should support those efforts to fight violent crimes. Now, Foreign Affairs Minister François-Philippe Champagne called the envoy's statements inappropriate. He said, quote, the reported comments by the Chinese ambassador are totally unacceptable and disturbing. I have instructed Global Affairs to call the ambassador in to make clear in no uncertain terms that Canada will always stand up for human rights and the rights of Canadians around the world. So with all these stories received this week, it's clear that the Chinese government, through many different corporations, has been infiltrating all levels of Canadian society, from government down to education, health, business, and even sleepy resort communities in coastal BC. It's time that the media report more on these intrusions and that our federal government actually does something to safeguard our national security.
And just as we were talking about back in August, you know, we've even had stories of the Chinese government lobbying cabinet officials. And this is just more evidence to show that this is happening not only at the government level, it's happening at the diplomatic level, it's happening at the business level, and it's even happening in, you know, what you would think would be one of the farthest away points in Canada, Salt Spring Island in BC. And, you know, there has to be a question at some point about what exactly is going on here. What is China's goal with this? And how exactly is Canada going to ensure that we are taking the necessary precautions on this? And, you know, diplomatic relations can ebb and flow. We've seen that with various other countries out there, one of them, of course, being North Korea, where there's a period where you have good relations and there's a period where you have bad relations. And that's just natural when you're dealing with an unstable democracy or a dictatorship or an authoritarian regime. And, you know, perhaps it's time to have an inquiry at the federal level about it. Are we being too kind to China? Are we taking the necessary steps to ensure our national security? Are we taking the necessary steps to ensure the security of our businesses? And, you know, we go back all the way to the story of Nortel and how they were taken down by Huawei, effectively. One of the biggest telecom companies in the world was taken down by Huawei, which now penetrates everywhere with its 5G technology. And that's a question that the federal government really, really needs to answer. The media needs to talk about it, too.
Yeah, all these different stories, they're not just one-off stories. They're all related. And they all point to a very insidious plan by the Chinese government to infiltrate Canadian society. And we've been seeing it happening, and we've been seeing it happening for years, but the media hasn't been talking about it. The government hasn't been doing anything about it. And it's clear that they've been very free to accept Chinese money and Chinese incomes coming into Canada through money laundering, through real estate, through the purchase of Canadian companies, whether it's retail goods or healthcare or transportation or shipping. And, you know, we've seen them get into education now, and there, they've even got boot camps on our secluded islands now, it seems. And it's amazing that this is all going on and the media is not talking about it. And even ourselves, who look into the news daily to find all these unheard stories, we didn't see it until now. And I think that's really something, when the media will see a huge story like this and completely bury it. And you have to wonder what's going on and what our Canadian government is going to be doing about this. Now, something that Aaron O'Toole said very firmly when he was elected leader of the Conservatives was that he was going to be very strong on China. And since then, the media has tried to do their best to not talk about O'Toole as much as possible. And I think that it doesn't seem like a coincidence that's been going on.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that we have to accompany the story is a picture of the week showing the people on Salt Spring Island in their military camouflage. And you have to realize that these aren't people on a vacation. There was definitely something going on there. We tried our hardest to find what exactly this would be, whether it be through some treaty or something to that effect, but we weren't able to find it. And as far as we can tell, nobody knows what exactly all those – they look like Chinese troops, I'm going to say it, what those Chinese troops were doing on Salt Spring Island. Nobody knows. And quite honestly, that's a big intrusion, which is also our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week is intrusion, which is defined as something that interrupts a peaceful situation. And Salt Spring Island could always be described as peaceful. And it can also be described as the act of becoming involved in something in a way that is not welcome. And I think that this intrusion into Canadian society, when people hear about it, they would find that it's very much not welcome. And I think that the media and the government throwing this under the rug is doing a disservice to Canadians who probably don't realize that this is going on. And it's quite clear that this whole intrusion into Canadian society is something that's going completely unreported, and it's something that should be talked about a lot more.
Yeah, and you know, the very fact it's not in the media goes to what we talked about in the Barrington story, how based on what data, what media you consume, and where you look online, you're subjected to a different reality than the rest of the population, and that reality is driven in large part by the media. Most of the time, they're right, but at times they can completely make a story disappear, and it ceases to be part of reality. And pretty much on all counts this week, that's what we were doing, presenting the alternate side of what the media wasn't. And you know, we have full supplementals and show notes available for all of these stories at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there, Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on social media where we'll be sharing these stories and more, including these episodes at Western Context on both Twitter and Facebook. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always be sure to look through all the stories that the media are talking about and a lot of the stories that they aren't talking about. No matter whether it's on radio, TV, print, or online, we will find them eventually, in some cases, and in a lot of cases we'll find them right away. And we'll be able to give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.